18 of them came in low over France, 50 feet off the winter ground, hedgerows blurring past in the snow, two Rolls-Royce Merlin engines running flat out, the whole airplane alive with speed and vibration and purpose. The pilots weren't studying their instruments, they were reading the frozen ground beneath them, watching the landscape scroll past, calculating, adjusting, trusting the navigator beside them and the airplane under them. They had a prison to hit, not to destroy it, to open it, specific walls, specific corners. A sequence of attack runs timed to the minute, measured in yards, not miles, a bombing problem that seemed almost impossibly precise by 1944 standards, being flown in an airplane that 6 years earlier, almost nobody in the British military wanted to build. I'm Tail Dragger, you're on Radio Hangar, and today pull up a chair because this is the story of one of the most remarkable aircraft to come out of the Second World War. An airplane built partly by furniture makers and piano manufacturers, an airplane that sometimes outran the fighters sent to shoot it down, an airplane that the Air Ministry rejected more than once and couldn't build fast enough once they finally understood what they had. This is the story of the de Havilland Mosquito. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation Challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Now, to understand why the Mosquito is such a remarkable story, you have to go back to 1938 and understand what the British Air Ministry believed about bombers. They believed in gunners. If you were going to put a bomber over Germany, over defended airspace, over radar networks and fighter patrols and anti-aircraft batteries, you needed defensive armament, tail guns, dorsal turrets, belly positions, you were going to be attacked, and you needed to fight back. That was doctrine. That was the assumed lesson of the last war and the coming one. Firepower and armor. That was how crews survived. Geoffrey de Havilland thought otherwise. De Havilland was already a legend by the time he walked into those Air Ministry meetings. He had founded his own aircraft company at Hatfield in Hertfordshire and had been drawing and building airplanes since the earliest days of the industry. He had a gift for clean, elegant design, for understanding what an airplane wanted to be rather than forcing it into a shape that doctrine demanded. And in 1938, he walked into the Air Ministry with an idea that must have sounded completely insane to the men in the room. "What if," he said, "we build a bomber so fast it doesn't need guns at all?" The Air Ministry said no. De Havilland went back. He brought his chief designer, Ronald Bishop, into the picture. He refined the proposal. Twin Rolls-Royce Merlin engines, a crew of two, and they were going to build it largely out of wood. The Air Ministry said no again. Wood. Just say that word in a room full of military procurement officials in 1938 and watch the expressions change. Here was the most industrialized air war ever fought, coming fast over the horizon, and Geoffrey de Havilland wanted to build something out of balsa and birch, like a model airplane scaled up to fighting size. But de Havilland had a logic, and it was sound. Wood did not compete with aluminum for manufacturing resources. Every metal aircraft factory in Britain was already running at capacity, fighting for the same raw materials, the same skilled machinists, the same supply chains being fought over by every branch of the military. But furniture shops? Cabinet makers? Piano factories? Those were an entirely separate industrial world, largely untouched by the war economy. The Beadall Piano Company in North London would eventually be producing Mosquito fuselage components. Skilled woodworkers who had spent their careers building fine furniture found themselves building airplanes, and they were very good at it. The construction Bishop developed was a sandwich. Two thin skins of birch plywood bonded to a core of balsa wood, the whole thing glued together with a formaldehyde-based adhesive called resin W that set hard as stone. The fuselage was built in two halves, each one laid up in a wooden mold, and then the halves were married together. The result was a structure that was smooth, stiff, and lighter than any comparable aluminum design. Weight is everything in aviation, and the Mosquito structure was magnificently light. Through 1938 and most of 39, the proposal kept getting declined. De Havilland kept pushing. Then Poland fell, then France fell. And the men in Whitehall started reading the proposal with different eyes. In the autumn of 1939, de Havilland got a cautious go-ahead, not an enthusiastic endorsement. A "let's see what you can actually produce." A limited contract later pared down to just a prototype study. They still didn't fully believe in it. De Havilland's team had never really stopped designing. The prototype took shape at Hatfield through the winter and spring of 1940, while the Battle of Britain was being fought in the skies overhead. They finished it in an experimental yellow color scheme for visibility during test flights. They called it W4050. On the 25th of November 1940, Geoffrey de Havilland Jr. climbed into the left seat and lifted it off the Hatfield grass for the first time. His father stood on the ground and watched. The reports that came back were almost hard to believe. In initial testing, with engines deliberately detuned to protect them in early flight work, the prototype was hitting close to 390 miles an hour. Full military power in production variants would eventually push certain marks above 415 miles an hour at altitude. To put that in perspective, the Supermarine Spitfire Mark I, the aircraft that had saved Britain just months before, had a top speed of around 355 miles an hour. The Hawker Hurricane was slower still. The Mosquito Bomber, unarmed and undefended, was faster than both of them. If a German fighter came after you, the answer was not to turn and fight. The answer was to push the throttles forward and fly away. Because you could. The Focke Wulf 190, one of the finest fighter aircraft the Luftwaffe produced, had a top speed that a fully developed Mosquito could walk away from. The pilot chasing you would eventually run low on fuel and have to break off and go home. There is something almost philosophical about that. The Germans built some of the finest fighter aircraft in the world. The British answer, at least for this one remarkable machine, was to build a bomber that could outrun them. The Air Ministry that had said no twice was now signing orders as fast as they could put pen to paper. The bomber variant came first, then photo reconnaissance, then a night fighter version, packed with radar equipment and cannon armament. Then a fighter bomber with four 20mm cannons and four Browning machine guns in the nose, plus a bomb bay, the same wooden airframe kept producing new capabilities. 7,781 Mosquitoes were eventually built in Britain, in Canada, in Australia. The bomber crews started doing things that simply weren't supposed to be possible. In May of 42, six Mosquitoes from 105 Squadron flew at low level all the way to Cologne, in broad daylight, just hours after the famous 1,000 bomber raid had hit the city. It was a demonstration as much as an attack, a message about what this airplane could do. On the 1st of January, 1943, the Royal Air Force staged a raid specifically designed to disrupt a New Year's Day radio address by Hermann Göring. The Germans were broadcasting it live. Mosquitoes from 105 and 139 squadrons hit Berlin just as the broadcast was beginning. Göring's speech was cut off. Berliners heard air raid sirens and anti-aircraft guns and the distant sound of bombs, and then they heard nothing because the broadcast was dead. It was a raid planned almost as theater, and it worked, because the Mosquito could fly from England to Berlin, hit the target, and get home before the defenses fully understood what had happened. The night fighter variant earned its own legend. Wing Commander John Cunningham, flying Mosquitoes with the de Havilland Airborne Interception Radar, became one of the most successful night fighter pilots of the war. The press called him Cat's Eyes Cunningham, suggesting his night vision was exceptional. The truth was he had the radar, and the Air Ministry would rather attribute his success to carrots than reveal the existence of the equipment. Now here's where it gets interesting. All of that history, all of those variants and capabilities and raid stories, comes down to a specific morning in February of 1944. The French resistance had been taking serious losses. The Gestapo had been systematically hunting resistance networks across northern France. Amiens Prison, a 19th century stone fortress about 80 miles north of Paris, had become what amounted to a collection point for captured resistance fighters. Intelligence reports put the population at over 200 prisoners, many of them known resistance members. The information coming out of those networks said that executions were imminent, not eventual, soon, within days. Group Captain Percy Pickard was given the mission. Pickard was 30 years old, one of the most experienced and decorated low-level attack pilots in the Royal Air Force. He had starred in a wartime documentary film called Target for Tonight that had made him briefly famous across Britain. He was exactly the kind of man you assign to something that shouldn't work. The plan was intricate. Three waves of Mosquitoes staggered in time. The first wave would breach the outer prison walls at two specific points. The second wave would destroy the guards' quarters. The third wave would assess and bomb again if the first two had not completed the job. The sequence mattered as much as the accuracy. Too fast, and the guards would secure the prisoners before they could run. Too slow, and the whole thing was pointless. They flew on the 18th of February, snow, covered the fields, cloud base sat below 500 feet. The kind of morning that should have scrubbed everything and sent everyone back to the mess for breakfast. Pick led them out anyway. The formation crossed the English Channel, came up over the French coast, and flew the entire route to Amiens at 50 feet, reading the terrain, threading through the winter landscape, navigating by roads and railways, and the frozen patchwork of fields beneath them. At that speed and that altitude, the margin for error in navigation is essentially zero. You are reading the map against the world rushing past at over 3 miles a minute, and if you misread something, you have almost no time to correct. The first wave came in on the prison walls and dropped their bombs at the calculated angles. The masonry came apart, gaps opened, real gaps, wide enough for a man to run through. The second wave hit the guards' quarters, direct hits. When the crews of the third wave looked down and assessed the damage, they held their bombs. The job was already done. The walls were breached, the guards' building was in ruins, and the blast concussion had blown cell doors off their hinges throughout the facility. 102 prisoners got out through those gaps in the wall. Some were recaptured within hours, but more than half made it into the French countryside and disappeared. Resistance members who had been waiting for a firing squad walked out into the February snow. Group Captain Pickard did not come home. A Focke-Wulf 190 caught his mosquito on the egress, on the way out, and shot it down over a French field. He was 30 years old, one of the finest low-level pilots who ever flew for the Royal Air Force, and he went into the ground on a Tuesday morning in France. Aviation always keeps that ledger, the mission that worked, the man who didn't make it back. The historians have argued about Operation Jericho for 8 decades. Some believe the intelligence about imminent executions was overstated. Some believe the timing was off and the raid came too soon. Others point to the men who escaped and lived through the war and say simply, ask them.
What no historian disputes is the flying itself. 50 feet off the ground in a February snowstorm, with a bombing problem measured in yards and a timing requirement measured in minutes, the Mosquito crews did something that was extraordinary by any standard of airmanship. And the airplane made it possible. The wooden airplane that the Air Ministry had rejected, that the piano factories had helped build, that flew faster than the fighters sent to catch it. There are very few Mosquitoes left. The wood construction that gave the design so many advantages also made preservation difficult. Moisture and time have claimed most of them. But a handful are still flying, some of the Canadian-built examples surviving better in drier climates than in the damp English air where most of them were born. When you hear a mosquito at an air show, you hear two Merlins running together. And there's something about the sound that is different from a single-engine Merlin. It's busier, more complex, the harmonics of the two engines playing against each other in a way that takes a moment to identify. And when the pilot pushes up the throttles and the thing accelerates down the runway, you understand immediately why the crews who flew these airplanes love them the way they did. Hermann Göring, according to a well-traveled quote, once said that the sight of the Mosquito made him turn green and yellow with envy. The Air Ministry that rejected the design 3 times never produced that reaction in anyone. Geoffrey de Havilland did. The de Havilland Aircraft Heritage Center in Hertfordshire and the Imperial War Museum in London have been my sources today, along with aviation historian Francis Mason's work on the Mosquito's service history. More at RadioHangar.com. I'm Taildragger. Keep the blue side up.